Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
Thank you, Don. It's 10:14 on WGN. I'm in the Allstate Skyline Studio, a comfortable, familiar spot for me, though I was not here last Saturday and last week, as I was in England, in the United Kingdom. We were in London, and then we went up to Edinburgh, Scotland, with a bunch of WGN radio listeners. So thanks to you all for holding down the fort. I heard you did admirably. You know, us talk show hosts are an insecure lot. We want the show to go well, but not too well. And I heard that it was just super swell. So thanks to everybody. And thanks to all of the people that went with us. And then I was going to mention some names, and I probably shouldn't go down this road because I don't have the list of all of the people we traveled with, and I don't want to leave anybody out. But to Karen, who said goodbye to me as I was grabbing my bag, and to Jay and Shirley and Sue Cox and the Bissetts and the Oddings and Frank and Lori and the Letarts and Dawn and her sisters and another Dawn and her husband who listened to us, Brian in Nashville. We had a nice mix of folks. We were 3 days in London, and then a day of travel to Scotland, and then we spent 3 days there in Edinburgh. It was a Steve Bertrand travel trip. Steve does a nice job with these things. Visit SteveBertrandTravel.com to find out about more of these kinds of travel opportunities. You know, it's funny because you just cannot help but be reminded when you go to any place in Europe or the United Kingdom, and that is we in this country measure old things in decades. They measure old things in centuries. And it's really weird, London is, because you'll have there a very large, modern, changing city with contemporary, odd-looking, new construction buildings of steel and glass in the shapes of a vase and a gherkin pickle. They call it the gherkin, and a cheese grater. They call a building there the cheese grater, and a building that looks like a sugar refinery, and the modern, multicolored new Google buildings that are going up. And then you'll see those things next to Big Ben, or the Tower of London or something. It's just jarring almost, the modern and the very, very, very old living next to each other. Language was not a barrier in London that I thought it might be, but with them speaking London and all, we were able to understand them real well. Not so much in Scotland. Scotland, sometimes you just go, wow, I recognize a lot of those syllables. No idea what you just said. Thanks. Yeah, great. That's what you do. One of the people in our group said to a person from Scotland, do we sound as odd to you as you do to us? And they go, oh, gosh, yes. Which is funny because I think we speak the perfect English. We speak in the Midwest, particularly the least accented version of the common language. By the way, in Scotland, I did eat some haggis. I'll talk about that with Steve Bertrand on Monday. It was the reason I think we went on this trip. Steve said, go to Scotland, eat some haggis. I did. I'll talk about that on Monday. I survived. You know, 9 million people live in London. It's a big city. Chicago is a big city. London looks and feels a little bit like New York, without as tall a skyline, but just as multicultural and broad and bustling. 9 million people live in London, and 1 million people commute into the city every day to work. It's the second most ethnically diverse city in the world. Toronto, one of the tour guides said, is one. And then London is number two for over 100 languages spoken, over 100 nationalities represented. And I thought about that after I heard that. If you took a picture or just walked down a street, if you were dropped into London and someone said, okay, where are you? You would not guess London. If you have an image in your mind of what a Londoner looks like, do they all look like, you know, Paul, George, and Ringo? The answer is no. They look Indian. They look African. They look Middle Eastern. They look United Statesian. They look everything because they are such a blend. We were at the Tower of London one day, which is not a tower, by the way. It's a castle. And this is just a quick snapshot of what our group was like. So here we are, 35 or 36 people in our group. This is maybe the 12th trip that Brenda and I have taken. The third was Steve Bertrand's travel company, SteveBertrandTravel.com. And the other 9 or so or 10 or so with Kelly Cruises, KellyCruises.com. We're going to Paris and then up the Seine to Normandy in August. Still berths available in that if you want to come, by the way. But this is what it was like for this particular group. And we've been on a dozen trips now. Never one so gangly. Never one so people just wandering off or showing up late or just as we were walking, say, on a walking tour, getting so stretched out that we'd get separated. So it sort of became this sort of, there was almost an esprit de corps where we were all saying, okay, you know, where's the Johnsons? Okay, they're over there. Do you see them over here? Okay, let's stay together, everybody. We had a really good tour guide, but she walked a little fast. So we're at the Tower of London, which is really just a remarkable castle. The same day that the London Marathon is running by, as we're going through this ancient walled city, you hear the cheers of tens of thousands of people cheering on the London Marathon, which was just a block away. So we got to see a little bit of that. And that was really swell. The next major thing for us to do that day was then to go to the London Eye. The London Eye is that giant Ferris wheel with platform-size cars that you go into, great big cubes, and it very slowly moves around and you get a view of the city. While we were in the Tower of London, our bus drove away, parked, and then it was going to come back and get us and take us to the Eye. And in that process, it got a flat tire. A puncture, as they call it. So we're all standing at the bus stop, and the bus doesn't pull up because it has a flat tire. And our tour guide said, you are not going to miss the Eye of London. This is why one of the reasons you're here. It's great you got to go see it. We're like, well, there's 35 of us. We're going to start grabbing cabs. And it's just really important for you all to stay together because tickets and events are organized, and you can't just all go willy-nilly and then think you're going to reconnect later on because we don't know what's going on. So the tour guide says, okay, you are all going to join me, and we are going to take the tube. We're going to take the subway. So she runs off, runs to the tube station, runs back with 35 tickets, hands them out, and says, let's go. And this is a group with some people in their 40s and a few people or more in their 80s. Let me put it to you this way. Nothing is so easy to use as a public transportation system that you know, but nothing is more intimidating than riding for the first time on one you don't know. Literally, you stand in front of the thing that asks for your ticket, and you go, oh, what way do I do this? And that's me, by the way. I'm impersonating me. They go just, and you know, the locals are bam, doom, bam, doom, they're in, out, boom, 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 boom. And you're going, how does this thing work? I'm from America. So we all get through those little turnstiles, and we get down to the platform. We can't all fit on the same car. The guide is like, okay, get in the cars. We're going to go. Now she can't tell us when to get off. Three stops. Count three stops. She has very little expectation that we'll do that. We all get off, and then she says, now we have to transfer to the next train going a different direction. And we do that, and we finally arrive at the London Eye. If we got on a plane at that moment and flew back, we would have said, wow, that was a great trip, because it was kind of an adventure just riding the spontaneously public transportation system there successfully. We got to the London Eye in a place. The London Eye is like one of these, you know, like I said, it's a giant Ferris wheel. It's one of the things you're supposed to do when you go to London. I don't know if I want to do that, ride a Ferris wheel. In fact, the location does have sort of the feel of Navy Pier, which also has a giant Ferris wheel as well. But I would recommend you do this if you go to London, because the thing is enormous. And what we did was we bought the first class ticket. It's not that expensive. It's worth it. You get in this moving car that comes along. The Ferris wheel never stops. The door opens up and you all just walk in, and you better walk in right now because it's not going to stop. And you get in there, and then it's a platform with some seating, actually. And your car, your bubble, then goes around very slowly, about 45 minutes. Our version of that had champagne. A woman got on with us, said, that's the Tower of London over there, that's that over there. We looked at some of the sights through the glass. We sipped champagne, did toasts and pictures. Just about the time you've seen it all, you get off. Very much worth the time and very much worth the effort. Just one other quick note about that. Well, I'll just say this. We spent 3 days in London, and then we had tickets for an 11 a.m. train to Edinburgh. So we go London, 3 days, and now we're going to take a train up to Scotland. The train we got on goes 125 miles an hour for 4 hours. Boom, boom. Very fun. We bought the first class ticket. Again, that's about 100, maybe a little more a person. And for 4 hours, you're sitting in a little, well, you're sitting in train cars. The seats are grouped in pairs, two facing this way, two facing that way. You're on a little bench with a table in between. And if you get the first class ticket for about $100, you have this four-hour journey through the countryside of England. You see the city disappear, and then you see sheep and rolling hills. It includes unlimited beverage. They keep coming by with food. It's just really like you're sitting in first class on an airplane, but for far less, you're on the train, and it's even better because the ground is right there. A couple of highlights from our trip. Oh, and one other note. There was one thing that the locals say we do not want to talk about, that all of the Americans want to talk about. Guess what that is after this. 1027 WGN, this is John Williams. Good to be back. My body says, no, wait, it's not 1027. It's 6 or 7 hours later, because that's what happens when you go to the UK and then come back. And everybody said, you're not going to work Saturday, are you? Oh, yes, I am. This week on Chicago's Best, if it's what you you guys are pretty much always craving, pizza, check out Chicago's Best Pizza, Sunday night at 10 on WGN-TV. Major explosion today at a silicone processing plant, or a plant that makes with chemicals silicone in Waukegan. The numbers that we have now are 1 dead, 2 missing, 4 injured. At least those were the numbers a couple of minutes ago. And in just a few minutes, Don Kleppen will update you on that very latest news. It was a catastrophic explosion. It blew one of the buildings to pieces. And the situation there is dangerous enough now that emergency crews aren't even able to fully address it. Details on that in just a minute. I've been gone the past week and weekend in England with a bunch of WGN radio listeners. It was a Steve Bertrand trip. Early on, our guide named Sandra said, welcome to Great Britain. She was really lovely. She was Scottish. And she said, welcome, and guess what? We don't want to talk about Brexit. It was a common thing wherever you went. They're polarized and exhausted about it. It is so very much like our conversations here about our president. It's divisive. People say they don't want to hear about it there. We don't want to talk about that here. And then everybody ends up talking about it. In Scotland and in the city of London, they're for staying in the EU and the outlying areas where people feel more threatened by immigration. They're against it, and they're making no progress on it. This was a letter to the editor of the Evening Standard on Monday. It's very short, but I just couldn't help but notice that if you said they're not talking about Brexit, this is in the United States, and they're talking about the president, you might have the very same conversation or letter. I'm ashamed of this country right now. Is anyone else scared about what is happening to this country, writes a man named James Holyfield to the Evening Standard of London. We have no leaders. MPs are being called traitors. Canvassers have been punched. Nigel Farage is heating up his cauldron of poison. Language is nasty. We need to calm down and remember our manners. We need to respect the views of others and revisit the fine art of compromise. If we dig the trenches any deeper, it almost seems as if a civil war may break out. I'm so embarrassed and ashamed of my country right now. Is there someone out there who is able to lead us out of this mess? With more elections on the horizon, such person would get my vote. And he's talking about Brexit. It's 10:30. We've got the news. That's next on WGN. Thank you, Don. 10:39. We'll keep you posted. What a bizarre, tragic, sad story today in Waukegan. Producer Griffin just got off the phone with an attorney representing the company who's not going to join us just now. But, boy, there's a lot of questions we just all can imagine and we don't have the answers to yet. Like, what caused this? Are there any other dangers there? They say it might be 24 to 48 hours before they get this thing addressed. And as you heard Don just say, it is not expected that they'll find the two missing bodies alive. That sounds a little presumptuous, doesn't it? We don't like to say that, but that's what they said. And we'll keep you posted on what's going on there. If you heard or saw or felt that explosion, I'd be interested in your observation. My number is 312-981-7200. You can call or text. We'll keep you posted on that story. The weather down here, well, first here in Chicago is going to be lovely today. 50s today and 70 degrees and sunshine tomorrow. Joe, you and I don't like looking at weather apps, but that's what we do. And they're saying in Kentucky at around 3 o'clock, Louisville, 80-90% chance of rain for the Derby.
Yeah, it just kind of starts a little low and then raises up as it goes along. Yeah, I'm seeing the same thing, though.
Do you know who Larry Kalmus is? C-O-L-L-M-U-S? Kalmus?
I can't say I do.
I couldn't either until just this morning, but he is the guy that is going to be calling the race for NBC. He's been doing it for a while, since 2011. There's a Reuters story today that notes that he may be best known, though, even though for, 8 years now, he's been calling the Kentucky Derby on the network. He may be best known for an otherwise obscure race in Monmouth, New Jersey in 2010. The video has gone a bit viral. Reuters writes it this way. On a soggy summer's day in Monmouth, New Jersey, two horses in the same race had similar names. One named My Wife Knows Everything, and the other The Wife Doesn't Know. As fate would have it, the two horses vied for victory down the home straight.
Rojo's tuned third at the rail, and then comes My Wife Knows Everything and The Wife Doesn't Know, followed by Eleni's Hope on the inside, five off the lead. The half was in 48-3. Past the half-mile pole, Little Miss Macho is in second. On the far outside, The Wife Doesn't Know is moving up and is now fourth and right alongside of My Wife Knows Everything. My Wife Knows Everything and The Wife Doesn't Know are moving together on the far turn, and they're coming after Lady Mutata coming to the quarter pole. Here come My Wife Knows Everything and The Wife Doesn't Know on the far outside. Little Miss Macho is fourth. They're into the stretch. Lady Mutata, My Wife Knows Everything. Center of the track, The Wife Doesn't Know. Into the final furlong, My Wife Knows Everything. The Wife Doesn't Know. They're 1-2. Of course they are. My Wife Knows Everything in front. To the outside, The Wife Doesn't Know. My Wife Knows Everything. The Wife Doesn't Know. My Wife Knows Everything. More than The Wife Doesn't Know.
You know, what was beautiful about that is he didn't oversell it. You know, he just played it straight, but that's the way the race finished. I didn't even know who won. Was it My Wife Doesn't Know or My Wife Knows Everything? And by the way, he's single. He said the pressure of calling the Kentucky Derby and the whole atmosphere of it, it doesn't go down with experience, he said. So this is him talking about the race now.
Was that a TV call? Was that on TV?
You know,
it had to have been, right?
Yeah, right. I was watching video. It might have been a closed circuit thing because you don't have a lot of natural sound of the horses going.
But I just think it was accompanied video. That was not a radio call, is my question.
Correct. That accompanied video.
Okay.
That was sports broadcasting porn, for one. number two, I think typically the television announcers still just go at it like a radio call. I don't know if it's homage or if it's just, you know, the way it kind of goes. But
near the end, I guess the last name he said is probably who won, which is, I think, was The Wife Doesn't Know. Now I'm all twisted.
Well, he said a little bit more. The phrase I took was a little bit more than.
Well, that's right. The Wife Doesn't Know a little bit more. So does that mean.
Is that helping?
Kind of a double negative there, fella. I'm not sure what we know about who won that race. Griff, why don't you cue it up to the last 20 seconds of that or so? We'll give Dan Fogelberg a pass. And let me know when you've got your hand up on that. But you're right, because they do it like radio play-by-play. But the thing is, too, even if you can watch it, you don't know who's who maybe anyway.
So that's a good point.
Here's the end of the call on that race.
Into the final furlong. My Wife Knows Everything. The Wife Doesn't Know. They're 1-2. Of course they are. My Wife Knows Everything in front. To the outside, The Wife Doesn't Know. My Wife Knows Everything. The Wife Doesn't Know. My Wife Knows Everything. More than The Wife Doesn't Know.
Kill the music. So My Wife Knows Everything won that race.
Yes,
right?
Yeah.
Yes. Again, I just, it's funny because obviously the names are so quirky, but man, he really is great. It's funny because I didn't know his name, and I wish I did, but I have taken kind of a note of all the calls that he's recently had. The American Pharaoh, I think when he won the Triple Crown, it was American Pharaoh, he is magnificent. And I mean, again, this is a totally personalized take for me, because, you know, I just love to study this kind of stuff. And it's just so cool. His voice acceleration, how it builds up. You can understand how exciting the play is without even knowing what's really going on.
Well, think about it. If you're doing the Super Bowl, that would be the marquee game for a football announcer. But it's a three-hour conversation with a whole bunch of people. The analyst, the play-by-play guy, the sideline reporter, the horseshoe at halftime. So you've got a bunch of people. Here, it's a singular voice. It's for less than 2 minutes. And you can't get it wrong. In fact, you really don't have time to stumble. So it really is kind of a unique broadcast moment, isn't it? It would be as if, I don't know, somebody makes a shot and you win the gold medal in the Olympics, and you want to get that moment right because it's always going to be remembered. The signature play and the Cubs winning the World Series, you want to get that right. The Kentucky Derby is always like that. It's always no backing up, no do-overs, and nobody to help you. It's one voice, and he's pretty good.
Well, and not only that, even if the horse has a few feet lead, you still have to sell that moment. I mean, that's one race every year, and that's the world to a lot of people. So you can't really undersell it, even though it's a runaway for the leader. You have to really punctuate that call.
Kind of appropriate, too, right, that the wife knows everything won. And my wife doesn't know lost. If the wife didn't know that lost knew, then that horse would have won. So the one that didn't know lost,
nice.
And the one that does know everything, my wife knows everything.
I thought you were claiming it to like a metaphor of real life. Like, oh, the husband's argument is coming right on the side, but in the end, he doesn't win still.
It was a battle of wits. And it's obvious who would win, yeah.
So while I was gone, James Holzhauer kept winning, huh? The Jeopardy guy from Naperville?
Yeah, I watched him a few times this week.
How'd that go?
Well, it's interesting for a while, and then it's like, not as, not as fun to watch.
Story in the Tribune.
But it's just crazy. It is a marvel.
There's a story in the Tribune which shows him as a four-year-old, and he was a whiz then. As a four-year-old. As a four-year-old, the Tribune, when he was four in 1989, did a story about him. Not now, looking back. When he was 4 years old, the Tribune was already writing about what a whiz kid this kid was.
Well, I'm not surprised. You have to be born with as good as he is. It's just, it can't be like he studied extra hard.
Right.
And is this much better. No, it's clearly like he's, born that way.
I was reading a quote from a woman who also won on Jeopardy, and they said, well, did you study? And she said, I studied state capitals with my daughter because she said you should know state capitals. So I did, but state capitals didn't come up. She said, you can't study for Jeopardy because would you have decided to pick funny hats as something to study? But that was a category she ran into. So you really can't study for Jeopardy. You've either got it or you don't. And when James Holzhauer was a four-year-old at Avery Coonley Pre-Kindergarten in Downers Grove, the teacher at the time was counting the students the first day of class. And she said, I said, there are 16 boys and 13 girls. I wonder how, and he goes, 29. What is 29? I'm not making that up. He's four. We have 16 boys and 13 girls. I wonder, 29. He was standing with the buzzer at the time.
The last episode I watched, one of the other guys on the panel took him. They were tied going into the first break.
Wow.
In Single Jeopardy. So not at the end of Single Jeopardy, but going into the first break. And that was exciting. And that did not last very long.
Well,
he got a slow start and then immediately corrected.
Going into Final Jeopardy, he had $47,000. His challengers had $4,600 and $5,800. He usually has it wrapped up before they get to the second round.
I think it's always impressive that those people have those kind of numbers.
At all.
Like, there's only so much money on the board. It seems like he has all of it. Some people have ended up with like $15,000, $16,000. That's the kind of thing you would win with almost usually, always. It's crazy.
There's a story. There's an op-ed in the Washington Post today. And it was retweeted and agreed with by a former multi-time Jeopardy champion. And they said he's ruining it. He's gaming it. He's making it not fun. His aggressive play, his searching for the daily doubles, he's gaming it. He's not winning
it. And there's always a contestant every once in a while who is really out there searching for the daily doubles, but not quite like him. He immediately goes for the thousands every time in every category.
They should put it then at the 200 or the lower cat. They should hide it from him now because they talk about his personal
but
algorithm.
That actually doesn't have to do with the Daily Double exactly. I think that's part of a larger strategy.
Oh yeah, right. Well,
like I think he just wants those thousands anyway, and because usually they're more often buried in the middle somewhere. I think.
Okay, so here's Charles Lane in the Washington Post today. He said James Holzhauer, 34-year-old professional sports gambler, also holds the record for the 5 highest single game winnings in the show's history. He's got the top 5 one-day scores in Jeopardy. To the multitudes who have rooted Holzhauer's on, I have one question. Do you not see that this guy is a menace? The only thing more troubling as a commentary on American culture than his grinning, relentless march to victory, regardless of when or if it ends, is that millions celebrate it. People seem not to care that Holzhauer's streak reflects the same grim, data-driven approach to competition that has spoiled, among other things, baseball, where it has given us the shift, win above replacement, swing trajectories, and other statistically valid but unholy invocations. This is the way op-ed writers write. Like the number crunchers who now rule our national pastime, Holzhauer substitutes cold, calculating odds, maximizing for spontaneous play. His idea is to select and respond correctly to harder big-dollar clues. The guy I saw on CNN today, who had previously won, said, "It's such an advantage to be there a second or third time." He said, "You sit there and watch it on the sofa, and you go, yeah, I know who the Queen of England was. Try doing it standing. Try doing it standing for half an hour, and try being the first one to buzz in." He said, "You don't see this on TV, but there's a little light that goes on, which is the soonest point at which you can buzz in. You can actually buzz in too early, and if you buzz in too late, you might not get the chance to answer it, even if you know. So it's as much a mechanical thing, and the incumbent always has that advantage." He said, "The people on Jeopardy are all kind of equally smart. There are no dummies there. This guy's a prodigy for sure, but those people may be just as able as him, but they're not as practiced as him. And that makes a world of difference." I don't know what the solution to that is.
Yeah, this op-ed is not wrong, but it's also, it's not like he's taken this strategy and has transformed himself, a mediocre competitor, into a champion. He would have been dominating anyway, I think. And he's just using this to rack up these insane totals, is what it seems like.
Okay, how about this?
Because he's still getting the answer. You have to get the answers right.
Well, that's true.
But I think they should just cut him off at like 2 million and get him out. Because you got to move on.
Okay, do you agree with Griffin that at some point we should cut the person off? There used to be 5 days.
I don't know why it still isn't. That's what it should be.
Ken Jennings went 74. Get a load of this. Ken Jennings goes 74. And then on the 75th game, he loses. I'm going to play for you the audio after a break of Ken Jennings losing on his 75th term because of what happened after that, after this. So, hey, let's cheer on the guy from Naperville. His brother's a delight, and he doesn't seem to be doing anything wrong. By the way, when we interviewed James Holzhauer's brother, the attorney Ian from Naperville, 2 weeks ago, he said, a lot of people don't know this, he's donating a lot of his winnings to local charities. He's won a lot of money. He is a millionaire now based on the winnings in the show. And he's giving, I don't know how much, but let's hope a lot of it away. Let's hope he keeps a lot of it. You can do whatever you want with that money. You earned it, fella. But he's got 22 wins. Ken Jennings won 74 times. Ken Jennings was almost on there for, what do we figure that was, Griff? 5 or 6 weeks, right, Ken Jennings?
I think more than that.
Well, let's see. 75 would be 5 times 25 weeks.
Over 2 months. 3 yeah. months, maybe.
25 weeks would be 4, 8,
Math.
12, 16, 20. That's half a year, for crying out loud.
Math.
Ken Jennings had a run.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Ken Jennings is on. This is the 75th one. It comes down to the final Jeopardy. Hit it.
The category is business and industry, and here is the clue, ladies and gentlemen. Most of this firm's 70,000 seasonal white-collar employees work only 4 months a year.
Most of this firm's 70,000 white-collar employees only work 4 months a year. And I was thinking, this was several years ago, Amazon? Maybe because it was seasonal. I don't know.
Nancy, you wrote down your response rather quickly, I thought. I hope it's correct. Let's take a look.
So too.
What is H&R Block? You're right. Your wager, 4,401, taking you up to 14,401. You have a $1 lead over Ken Jennings right now. And his final response was... FedEx, his wager was 5601. He winds up in second place with 8799. And Nancy Zerbe, congratulations. You are indeed a giant killer. Our new Jeopardy champion, 14,401. Ken, take a look at the audience. The audience is paying tribute to not only Nancy, but to you as well.
You know, to your point, Griffin, you're right. It didn't take a lot of money to unseat Ken Jennings. It wasn't an $80,000 wager.
You're not coming close to James with $14,000 on any day.
Yeah.
And I looked up. He was on for 75 games. You said his total winnings were $2.5
million. Yeah.
If James was on for 75 days, it's not. It's going to be close to that. It'd be probably over
tens of millions of dollars.
Over $10
million. By the way, so Nancy Zerbe beats him. The next day, she comes on as the defending champion and finishes in last place with $2. To the point of, they're all actually pretty smart. It's the champion has to make a mistake, or somebody's got to get lucky with the clicker because it's such an incumbent's advantage. Thank you, Don. This is John Williams. My only point about the Bears ignoring the 43-yard missed field goal is that, you know, don't invent a jinx like the Cubs had.
Right.
Don't turn it into that sort of thing. The Ricketts family and the organization generally did not embrace the whole, hey, we know, but we're not going to be jinxed now. Let's unjinx ourselves. Although, do you guys recall, after the Ricketts family bought the Cubs, did they bring a goat to Wrigley Field for a day to sort of reverse the curse? Did you guys remember that? I'm wondering. I remember that being a conversation. I don't remember if they did anything with that or not.
I don't remember.
I would advise
that.
Against it. You know, get a black cat out there and see if you can take a grounder, or try and catch a foul ball down the left field line and see if you can reverse the curse that way. You get it? No, don't do that, Bears.
The Ricketts were like, we don't need to acknowledge any other curse. We will be the curse. We will embody the curse.
Trust us, folks. We've got plenty of controversy coming down the pipe. You just wait. The Mincing Rascals is a podcast we record here at WGN Radio Studios. I wasn't here on Thursday when we normally record it, but the gang still did, and we dropped it on Thursday afternoon. We'll start with Eric Zorn, the Tribune columnist. You'll also hear Eric Rung, who is an anchor here at WGN Radio, and our own Steve Bertrand kicking around a few issues of the day. It begins with Zorn's introduction.
And I am your presumptuous guest host, Eric Zorn of the Tribune, filling in this week for the vacationing John Williams, who's about to be Wally Pipped.
I'm Steve Bertrand, the host of the Business Lunch on WGN Radio.
And I am Eric Rung. I'm a reporter at WGN Television, as well as an anchor here at 720
WGN. And now back to Wally Pipped.
You guys got the Wally Pipped reference, right?
Everyone knows Wally Pipped. Eric might not have, because he's under 50.
Right. I don't get the reference.
1925, Wally Pipped was the starting first baseman for the New York Yankees, and he had a headache one day, so they put a kid named Lou Gehrig into the lineup.
Oh.
And Pip never started another game at first base again. So we're going to see what happens with John and hosting this podcast. First topic I want to talk about is blackface. Photos and video posted to social media last weekend showed a small group of white Homewood Flossmoor High School students riding around in a car wearing blackface makeup and joking around. This sparked a walkout protest at the school, which is 70% black, demand that the students be expelled. Blackface is racist and offensive. There's no question about that, but it's not illegal. Should a public school be able to expel students for performing an offensive but legal act off campus? Steve Bertrand.
Were they also accused of saying derogatory things about African-American girls?
They were accused of making fun of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right, which I think is a big mitigating factor here, but
mitigating or aggravating?
Aggravating. I'm sorry. You're right. This might be unpopular, but I just don't feel that schools. I don't know when it became the fact that schools are responsible for punishment of young people 24/7. I mean, I see inside the school building, I see at sporting events, but I don't think that they should be punishing students for what they do outside of school. And I don't think they should be held responsible for it, too, either, because the schools are in an unfair situation on this, too.
Right. I mean, it was. It's legal to wear blackface.
It's not defensible.
It's not defensible, but it is legal. It is speech. It's offensive speech, Eric.
Steve, you make this argument over the past week here in the newsroom as well, and I tend to agree with you here because it wasn't on school grounds. Now, if it happened on school grounds, absolutely.
Much different.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, they should have say in the punishment. Off school grounds, I mean, that goes back to parenting, I think.
But how about that? I mean, it does seem now that schools are responsible for punishing kids,
well,
no matter what they do, when they do it.
Isn't part of it though social media, right? I mean, part of it is that social media, it bleeds over into so much other stuff that the line between what's in school and what's out of school gets blurred by Instagram and Facebook.
I think that's part of it. I also think it probably started earlier when there were real crackdowns on high school drinking. And they started extending, you know, the punishment that way. So if you were in sports and you were seen in it with a red cup or something, you know, no matter what time of day or where it was, we could take you out of all extracurricular. I mean, I think that's when the punishment sort of, or the duty of schools or responsibility of schools started expanding.
Yeah, of course. But of course, sports is not a right. Like public education is a right.
I understand that. But I think, and it's a chicken or egg thing, but I think it probably started with the idea of cracking down on drinking.
Yeah,
with the code of conduct. Right, I mean, that's where it all came from, for sure. I remember when I was in high school, I had to sign a document saying that I would not drink at any off-campus parties or anything like that. Absolutely. That's where it came from.
Yeah. Of course, drinking is illegal for high school students. I mean, I know it's not.
You keep going back to blackface not being illegal.
I do, because I think, I mean, if these kids had robbed a bank or something like that, or had done something illegal, it's a deplorable thing, and it's interesting to me that blackface has become an issue in 2019.
Right.
But it does seem to me that this is obviously it's a teaching moment for the school, but there's a significant protest down there where people are demanding that they be expelled, demanding that they be, I'm sure they've been outed. I'm sure everybody kind of knows who
they are. Oh, absolutely. They already know who they are. And they already have security at the school, too.
And so my guess is those boys can never go back to that school. That would be.
Oh, I don't know. Have you reported on it? Are they going to go back to the school?
They're back at school.
I think they'll go
back. And they have security, according to other students at that school. You know, that was reported.
It's clearly another teaching moment for
this. What if they had been, and this is illegal, what if they had been convicted or busted for shoplifting?
Shoplifting is illegal. No, I know. But
do you kick them out of school?
But no, I think you don't. I mean, I think that shoplifting is clearly a minor.
What if they also were riding in the car wearing a swastika on their shirt something like that?
Again,
it's not illegal.
It's not illegal, but, you know, this is public education. You want to kick them out of a private school, yeah. But,
right.
I mean, kicking them out of a public school, I think there are other remedies. I mean, I guess I'm kind of with Steve. It's like, at what point does this become the school's business when you're doing something like that off school grounds?
And I kind of feel sorry for the schools because
it
becomes their responsibility, and I don't think it should be.
When I was thinking about this topic this morning, I was thinking, how would I feel if I'm like the principal of the school right now or the head of the school board having to make a decision like this? I think you would lose in court if you expelled these kids for this.
I don't think they'd be expelled. I don't think they could expel them.
There's a call for them.
There's a call for them.
This, you know, and this comes up with, we talked about this a little bit, and I got a lot of angry mail about the AJ Friend case. But I think we in the media make these stories bigger than they are. And not that it isn't a significant event at this high school, but I think sometimes we don't allow for the fact that 15-year-olds are doing stupid things. You know, and this was a case of 15-year-olds or 16-year-olds doing some really stupid things that need to be dealt with, punished, taught, but not necessarily made into a world-changing event.
I would agree with this kind of thing. I don't know how old these boys are. Actually, I don't know their ages either.
I want to say sophomores, but I'm not sure.
I'm guessing.
That.
I mean, it's clearly at this point.
Well, someone was driving.
Immature, and stupid, and probably racist. It's certainly a racist act.
I have a hard time believing that teenagers don't know that blackface is bad
by now. Yes,
by now,
absolutely.
I mean,
with all the coverage this year,
exactly, especially with the governor of Virginia. I mean, it's all over the news.
And you know how 16-year-olds watch
the
news.
Yeah, but I also think people do. That's why you ended up here, Eric.
I know.
Here with two has-beens talking about the news. I know of a person who, when he was that age, it's not me, scrawled something bigoted on a garage door. And he is the least bigoted person I know. I mean, absolutely, you know, can attest to this guy's character. But he was 15, and he was stupid, and he did it, and I know he regrets it still. So, I mean, I think there has to be some allowance for that, too.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that, too, and that, which is why, you know, the school's role in this seems to me to be one of you know, making it a teaching moment for the other students. And in also for the kids who did this, like I said, I'm skeptical these kids can actually go back and reintegrate, so to speak, with the school population these circumstances.
And I think the school's role, too, is to, you know, allow these protests to...
Oh, they think they have
which
to.
They, I mean, to vent and to speak and to voice their concerns as well.
Let's move on and talk about the inauguration. Mayor-elect Lori Lightfoot is asking local companies to pony up from between $25,000 and $100,000 to help pay for her May 20th inaugural festivities at the Wintrust Arena. And my question is, really? If corporations have that kind of money lying around, why not ask them to use it to fund educational or recreational opportunities in disadvantaged neighborhoods? Yes, lavish inaugurals are an American political tradition, but why not signal a new, more humble approach with a simple swearing-in ceremony at City Hall, followed by a rolling up of the sleeves and getting to work?
Well, I mean, that's a beautiful fantasy world that we would be living in if that was going to happen, but that's just not going to happen.
Well, I feel like, if in the case it would be Lori Lightfoot.
That would be great, but it's not going to happen. It's not.
I don't know any examples. The last one I could think of was J.B. Pritzker, who had his huge inaugural thing.
He had Maroon 5 or something.
He paid for the whole thing. So, you know, and Lightfoot is obviously not in a position to pay for the whole thing.
I remember covering Richard M. Daley's first inauguration. It was at Symphony Center, I believe, because we were perched in a balcony. So that, you know, that was very ornate. I think they got less and less so as he kept winning and winning.
I would think so. I mean, the first inaugural, maybe a little bit of fuss, but the second one, I don't even remember.
It's like a marriage, right? The first one's big. The second one, you know, don't even register.
I wouldn't know about that. And what's a company going to say? Right, a local company's gonna say no, mayor elect, we're not. So they're in an awkward position, and so it really has this odor of politics as usual.
It does seem like an odd way for her to start.
It does. Another thing that happened locally was the graduated income tax. Illinois moved a step closer to
Eric Zorn, Steve Bertrand, and Eric Rung talking about now the graduated income tax, which they all thought was a really groovy idea to tax the rich more. And Eric said that it would be fairer if you did that. I'm glad I wasn't in there because I would have been very hostile to that part of the conversation. I was away last week. Thank you, Eric Zorn, Steve Bertrand, and Eric Rung for filling in on The Mincing Rascals. You can always hear it wherever you hear your finer podcasts. It's free, The Mincing Rascals. Paul Sullivan has a piece today about the Cubs and Cards rivalry and the sometimes bad behavior of the fans. He also posted an A-Rod alert because Sunday Night Baseball this weekend will have Alex Rodriguez in the booth. People love to hate on A-Rod in the booth. I'm not smart enough to know what he's doing wrong, but some people sure don't like him. Let me tell you about one of my Joe, is that you commenting?
Yeah, sorry. It was very, very faint. Yeah, I don't understand why everyone is so critical about A-Rod either. I'm guessing it's just towards the end of his career when he was a very non-likable player. But I think he's very well-spoken on the air. I think he always brings a lot of good elements to the broadcast. I really enjoy him.
One of the greatest players ever. A cheater, so I think that's not helping him either.
Right.
If you're a cheater and a liar, I don't know. Some people get away with it, and they go, welcome back to the organization. I think people in St. Louis like Mark McGwire. People in Chicago don't like Sammy Sosa.
Well, I don't know so much about that. I think the fans do, but I think the organization has made it very clear that they really don't want to be associated with Sammy Sosa currently.
Yeah.
I think they are still waiting for an apology from him, but it's a business. It's a two-way street. Sammy Sosa made a lot of money for the Chicago Cubs in the 90s and 2000s.
Sort of resurrected the game, too. 3-2-1, Griff. 3-2-1. There it is. Things is not like the others, like a rainbow. Never find another like me. Ooh, ooh, ooh. 720 WGN in the Allstate Skyline Studio. I'm John Williams. Promise that nobody's gonna love you like me. About me. I know you never get. What do we got here, Griff?
What do you think?
That's Taylor Swift.
Hey, there you go.
Who has a really long back, by the way.
Desus and Miro, the new hosts of the show, Showtime talk show once a week called Desus and Miro. We're on Jimmy. I have to explain what you just said. You created this vortex that I have to fill. They were on Jimmy Fallon. They were playing Catchphrase with Charlize Theron and Jimmy. And the term was Taylor Swift. And Miro said, she has a very long back. And he immediately got Taylor Swift.
If we're playing a guessing game and I had to describe someone and I said, first, I don't know what the best way to look at that is. You have to describe Taylor Swift or you have to guess somebody has a very long back. Would you connect those two automatically?
They've joked about that, I think. It's just another way of saying that she's tall. It's just a weird way of saying that she's tall. They're just really goofy guys. I love that show. So that's been a wonderful, like, 20-second clip circulating online now of them. And Jimmy Fallon and Charlize Theron just standing there like, what?
How did you do that?
What just happened? Yes, that was her new song called Me with Brendan Urie, the lead singer from Panic at the Disco.
Have I been missing her stuff lately, or has she been sort of absent? Taylor Swift.
No, this is a pretty quick turnaround. I mean, Reputation came out less than 2 years ago, I think. That was her last album. She did a huge tour off of that with a Netflix special included. So she was gone for longer before that one than she has been for this one.
Well, that little clip you just played us, I thought was really not very good.
No, I don't love that. I've been a fan, too, in the past. I love a lot of Taylor Swift songs, genuinely. I'm speaking from the heart here, and this is not my favorite.
I'm giving it a 63, 1 to 100. What are you giving it, Griff?
Around there, 65.
Joe Brand, what are you saying?
Wow, I can actually picture myself listening to this song. It's a little high school-y. It's a little, hey, look at how great life is. But I enjoyed it. I'll give it an 83.
There you go.
I thought this was going to be your pitch to find a summer song for us, Griff, that it had sort of a bubblegum pop feel.
Oh, I think
feel.
That's definitely how it's being positioned,
but it's going to be a bad summer if that thing's competitive.
Well, I'm just gotten saying. Off to a terrible start.
Oh, I don't know. You know, I've been hard on it. Also, later in the song, it gets into this breakdown where they do sort of a chant where it's about, like, there's no I in team, but there is a me. That's the line. And that's just, like, very not my speed. It also, but criticizing it, I feel like a jerk. It's like, this is for children. It kind of feels like.
Right.
But the truth is that.
Let them have their song.
But in the past, her music hasn't felt that way to me. So I just, I'm sort of torn on that.
And by the way, there's no I in team, but there's me. There's M. There's no me in team. I'm sorry, that's very contrived.
Gosh, the egg on her face. Wow. You should call her. Oh, and I also considered playing a Vampire Weekend song. Their album, Father of the Bride, just came out yesterday.
Oh, wow. Is it good?
Very good.
Don, you've been busy over there. I know you're doing news. You don't have to play if you don't have time, my friend.
I want to play.
What have you got?
I would give this a 34. But I enjoy Taylor Swift. She's like, rather than long back, I would call her deer face. But I mean that in an attractive sense. She looks like a female deer, but a good looking one.
I didn't mean to open up this line of conversation, but
I'm now going to refer to myself as very long back.
Very long in the back.
Did you guys already touch on that? I miss that?
Yeah. I'll tell you what. I know that everybody's tired of talking about it, but just for consideration, 1 to 100, guys, the most recent episode of Game of Thrones, I'm giving it a 97 because I don't give 100s.
We could rate this season so far. We're three episodes in and we haven't talked about it yet.
Well, the second episode was as good as the third in a completely different way.
Right.
But I would say this. You saw the money. It was as action-packed as you'd hoped.
Oh, yeah.
There were twists, turns, and some resolutions. Man, I don't know what you wanted from episode 3, but it delivered. And
I can think of quibbles, but they would be quibbles. It was pretty incredible. But I have a couple.
Okay, go ahead, Griff. What's the problem?
I wanted one more marquee death. It felt a little...
I'm with you there. I'm totally with you there.
There's still three episodes, though.
There's plenty of time to sate my bloodlust, but
I
don't know how they get into that battle. And there were a couple shots at the end. I loved it.
What are you saying?
I'm going to give it a 93.
You're saying some of it was unrealistic? Is that what you're saying?
I know.
Is that your problem?
It doesn't correspond with what the show has been. I start sounding so nerdy talking about this. I hate it. What I have always loved about the show is that anything can happen. No one is safe. That's what hooked... I don't usually get into this kind of thing. And that's what really hooked me about in season one. when one major death, I guess I won't spoil it.
You're not including really the dragons, huh?
I don't know what you're talking about. The point is, I've always liked that no one is safe, truly no one. And I kind of could have guessed that a lot of those people would be safe because they're big characters. And that's not always how I felt about the show. So it's just signals a change in the show that's happened over the past few seasons. Last season felt this way, too. That's a quibble. I loved the episode.
Yeah, it, to me it was like, you know, this is what, season 8? Yeah, I mean, this is, and then this is kind of really the payoff of the last, I mean, several seasons, ever since they started fighting each other. So I think this is kind of, you know, whatever the episode was, like 80 minutes or something. And that I remember Kit Harington said it took him like 55 days to film that fighting sequence. They broke the record that Lord of the Rings set for longest, like, on-screen battle time or something.
Well, that's debatable, but yeah, I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, it was you know, in terms of like, you know, hey, like a Sunday night thing, like, yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, Sunday night, what's on? Oh my God, the best thing ever. That's what was on.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think you're totally right, but yeah.
I will always remember where I was, season 8, episode 3. I think it's a signature moment in American television viewing.
I actually liked episode 2 a little better when they were prepping for the battle. That was one of the best episodes of the show I've seen in a long time.
A completely different kind of show.
Totally different.
Episode.
It's true. It's true. Season so far... Oh, yeah, Joe, sorry. Go ahead.
No, you're fine. You're fine. I was just going to say that I thought season 2 was a little bit stalled out, but it had to be. I'm sorry, episode 2 of this most recent season was a little bit stalled out because it had to be. What I'm curious about, John, how were you able to not be spoiled with it on your way back from Europe? I mean,
you said you were
reading through on Twitter. If you do that, I mean, you're just setting yourself up for disappointment.
Well, I just say, let me answer for you. I think you don't know enough to, it's impossible to spoil you because you say, oh, someone did this and you don't know the names.
Right. Right. It would help if I knew more about the intricacies, like who's on what team, where do they live.
That's like the best approach to the show, though, who's to avoid the spoilers.
That's why I'm able to watch it almost, what's the word? I consume it differently than you guys do. I consume it almost physically. I just take in the visual imagery and the sound and the stuff. I don't get caught up in the intrigue. And I'm telling you, that was some amazing-looking television last night.
It was incredible. And it was totally engrossing. I was like, it was like very emotional. I was on the edge of my seat. Stuff that I rarely feel with any show ever. So that's totally true. And
we were
at the end of the episode when they pan around and who's left standing. It's like, oh, everyone you know. Everyone you don't know, they're probably dead. Everyone you know is good, though.
Yeah,
I took me out of it for a half a second. I have to speak my truth.
I understand what you mean. HBO gave the characters a little bit of plot armor, whereas George Martin sort of famously discarded that from everybody. So
that's the thing.
I get
your point. It's a change that's happened since they went off book, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so Don's 1 to 100 is...
I gave it 98, man. Yeah.
Joe Brand said...
I'm echoing off, Griff. I'll go with 93.
Copycat. 93. I'm a 97.
It's called echoing, not copycat.
That's a thing, huh? Washing your chicken. That's not a phrase. I literally mean washing your chicken. The Center for Disease Control came out this past week and said that when you cook chicken, you should not wash it. A lot of people are upset about that and said, no, I'm going to wash it. I'm going to get those germs off. They said, when you wash your chicken, you splash the germs all over the kitchen and all the other utensils.
Oh.
The worst thing you can do is wash the chicken. Put it in the oven. Kill the germs at 350 for 40 minutes or whatever you're going to do. You'll be fine.
Right.
People.
Why don't they just say responsibly wash your chicken then? A low stream from the faucet. That's it.
And again, we're speaking about chickens. We're not using that as an expression. Responsibly clean your chicken. I say 100 is don't wash your chicken. 0 is wash your chicken. I'm at a 98. I don't want to wash. No. I put it this way. I don't want to wash the chicken. I'm happy to let the germs die on the grill. Joe Brand, go.
I wash the chicken, but I don't think it's imperative. Just give it a couple of pat dries with a paper towel. You should be good.
Don, go.
I'll go 95. I don't want to wash it. I'll just throw that thing in the oven.
I don't even know what 95 means anymore now, but you're with me.
Yeah.
Don't worry about washing it. And Griff, have you washed a chicken?
Amy says wash it with a lemon.
Oh, nice. Ooh. Just kind of sprinkle a little bit around. That kind of kills it. And now you're not splashing it around in the kitchen sink.
I would like to err on the side of the Center for Disease Control. I feel like there's a lot of not listening to them going around lately, and it's driving me insane. So this is a smaller point. But how about just
salmonella?
Yeah, you're just team CDC. I get it.
Yeah, because I'm not an expert here. I'm going to default with them.
Well, that is such a good point. You're talking about people getting their kids vaccinated, and right. I think, really? If you're a doctor and there's 1,000 others of you, maybe you could have that conversation. But a lot of time it's just, somebody named Clem, and they go, nah, we don't like that stuff. And I just think that's a bad way to raise your kids. I'm sorry. Trust the experts on that. Sports wagering, 100, you like it. I'm thinking about it after the Kentucky Derby. And as much fun as it is, say, to bet on a horse, you're going to be able to bet on the Chicago Bulls if you want to someday, very, very soon in this state. Sports betting, 100, you like it. Joe Brand, go.
100. I think it'll pull in the traditional fan, the non-fans, just to be more interested into sports. I mean, you could do an over-under of made free throws in the fourth quarter, and then all of a sudden everybody is interested in something like that.
Yeah. Prop bets and stuff.
You're in for that then too, Don?
Yeah, I would say probably like 92-ish, but honestly, yeah, I think it's good. It'll make more revenue. I know plenty of people in my life drive all over the place to go to a casino and gamble anyway, so why not? Why not make it easier?
I'm worried about the people that are going to be sorry for this, but it's coming, and it's already happening. I suppose the people that are most vulnerable are already being taken advantage of. I don't love it like you guys do, but I'm going to give it an 86. Griffin Sports Betting, how much? You're Switzerland on this one?
Yeah,
you're neutral?
Totally. But yeah, no, if people want to, then go ahead. Right. I don't have any money.
Stop asking me.
It's such a moot point for Griff.
I'm going to not be doing that, but yeah.
All right, that's our Vibe Score segment for today. Thank you, fellas. Amy is here. She of lemon cleaning chicken fame. She'll tell us what's coming up on her show next. Amy Guth is in the studio getting ready for her show. Hi, Amy.
Hello. How's it going?
Pretty good. It just dawned on me. Let's talk for a couple minutes here. We have one more commercial break to take, but while you're in the studio, what's going on?
Well, we're going to take a look at some of the business around the Kentucky Derby, big horse day. Of course, I'm fascinated by horse racing, and I love talking about it and thinking about it.
You've been down there a few times.
I have been there a few times, and I'm always very interested in. I feel like it's a science of picking the right horse. So we're going to talk about that because there's a lot of brands that attach to this large event. There's also a really interesting piece in the New York Times right now about how farmers are having to adapt to the changing climate. And I've seen a little bit of reporting on that around the wine industry, but now it's a little bit broader conversation and people are talking about it in a bit bigger way because either fields are flooding and swallowing tractors or they're so dry they can't grow the crop that's grown there for 100 years. So farmers are kind of adapting to see what's what. And then we're going to talk about the IPO from Beyond Meat. It's kind of been a big week for IPOs. We've got a lot of IPO news floating around right now, but Beyond Meat, the pea protein based meatless alternative. I haven't tried it, but some people I know swear that it tastes like beef, whatever. So their IPO is happening and it's going very well for them. So it's Bloomberg called it history making already. So yeah.
On our flight back yesterday from the United Kingdom, the snack they served were two hot sliders, little bun sandwiches, and they were not meat. It was a vegetable concoction of some sort.
How was it?
It was fine. I wish I hadn't known that it wasn't meat because I can't get past my own precept that it's not the same and not as good.
Yeah.
If they said, hey, it's a pork blend,
sure.
I think I would have been okay with it, but I knew it was not meat. Sort of the way I approached haggis when I was over there, too.
If you don't know what it is, it's fine.
I would have been better off.
Put some sauce on it. Just keep going. Keep eating. That's right.
Amy Guth's right around the corner. The stories that matter from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom come up. Maybe you heard me mention that I just got back from a trip in England with the Steve Bertrand Travel Group. The next time we travel on this show, I hope you can consider coming with us, is to France. We'll go to Paris, up the River Seine to Normandy and back. KellyCruises.com is the place for that. I'm John Williams. Thank you, Joe Brand. Thank you, Don Kleppen. Bob Ferguson's the engineer. Griffin Philippich produced. He's going to work with Amy Guth now on her show.